Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight on this very wet evening where Joe Hockey makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's known very well throughout Australia, so I will introduce him very briefly as the former Treasurer of the Commonwealth Government and currently Australia's ambassador to the United States. And Ambassador Hockey is talking tonight at the Sydney Institute on the topic Disruption Goes Mainstream, a report from America. Ambassador, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and I'll just make a little room for myself here so I actually have some space. It's great to be back here at the Sydney Institute. And thank you to you and Anne for hosting me. It's an extraordinary time in global politics, and I hope that you do enjoy this presentation. In the first days after his inauguration, it was widely reported that Donald Trump had chosen to redecorate the Oval Office, as is the right of every incoming president of the United States, as part of putting his own stamp on the most famous office in the world. President Trump chose to hang a portrait of the 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, who was elected in 1828 at the conclusion of one of the most bitter and divisive presidential campaigns in United States history. In his quest for the presidency, Jackson unashamedly campaigned as a populist conservative. He was a fearless, disruptive individual who was inclined to resolve significant differences with his opponents by engaging in actual gunfights. That is, duels of 20 paces, with real guns. In Jackson's mind, you were either on his side or you were the enemy. In particular, Jackson campaigned heavily on his deep disdain for the Washington elite, and he sought to capitalise on the perception that the US federal government was not, quote, for the people. Rather, it was bloated and held its own people in contempt. Almost 200 years after Jackson served as president, the United States has once again embraced the campaign of a disruptive outsider. Americans rejected the status quo and yearned for someone to put their interests ahead of all other concerns. In 21st century politics, tradition, precedent, and custom mean little to the vast bulk of voters. Respect for most community institutions in the Western world is either low or falling. The scars of the global financial crisis are deep and painful. The cost of modern terrorism is high. Citizens across the world feel that their governments had failed to provide them with the personal and economic security that has been promised for generations. The combination of the Brexit vote and the US presidential election result shocked commentators, pundits, and pollsters, but it didn't shock millions of voters. On the 2nd of November last year, just 6 days before the presidential election, I delivered a speech in Sydney which, being as diplomatic as a former politician can hope to be, I stated that the presidential election in the United States was too close to call. Given this had been no ordinary American election campaign, I simply could not shake the feeling that the signs were pointing to an outcome that was in no way ordinary. In the time since November 8, I've met with a number of analysts who specialise in assessing the mood of the American people. Not their voting intentions, mind you, but how they really feel about a range of issues to deal with their lives, their country and the world in which they live. And I've found these interactions to be incredibly insightful And therefore, I've chosen to incorporate the primary work of a number of these experts in my address to you tonight. I'd like to thank Glenn Bolger of Public Opinion Strategies in Washington, and also Bruce Millman and David Castagnetti of Millman, Castagnetti, Rosen and Thomas for their graciousness in allowing me to cite some of their excellent analysis in my address. As you all see, their work paints a far more vivid and effective picture than any words could hope to do alone. Using this analysis, I wanted to recap quickly some of the key drivers for President Trump's victory. The first slide clearly illustrates that Trump attracted significant support from four traditional Republican constituencies, and importantly, in far greater numbers than Mitt Romney did in 2012. Firstly, non-college educated white voters. Secondly, those drawn from small cities and or rural areas. Thirdly, evangelical Christians. And finally, men. According to CNN, Donald Trump secured 53% of all votes cast by men. In a voluntary voting system, all four groups turned out in large numbers for Donald Trump on November 8th. And as we know, getting out the vote on Election Day in the United States is a crucial factor for a positive result. In focusing on these four key constituencies, however, what should not be lost is the strength of Donald Trump's support among groups that so-called experts presumed to be less receptive to his message. Two pertinent examples. Firstly, Trump secured 29% of the votes cast by Hispanic Americans on November 8. That was more than Mitt Romney secured 4 years earlier. And given the hysteria around the Mexican wall, it was a pretty remarkable vote. Secondly, and perhaps even more strikingly, Donald Trump won the votes of a majority of white women in America. 53% of the total votes cast, according to CNN, in an election where he was running against the first female nominee for president in history in the United States. So while many Australians, and it's said, got to be said many Americans, are still scratching their heads at the support Trump garnered from constituencies such as women and Hispanic voters, the key takeaway is that there were many significant issues that were driving the votes in the minds of most Americans. Unquestionably, in a nation that celebrates innovation and success, there has been a cost associated with the advent of digital technology. Factories have closed, towns have been gutted, wealth has rarely been more conspicuous and poverty more obvious. With the emergence of business and job disruptors like Google, Amazon, eBay, Uber, Tesla and Apple, and with the comparatively rapid emergence of a truly global trading platform beyond capital markets, people see and feel a community that is divided. Crucially, they identify themselves as being on the wrong side of the line. This plays out in the daily news. For example, every conversation about an innovation like driverless cars and trucks translates into a feeling of job insecurity for millions of taxi drivers, hire car drivers and truck drivers. According to the US Census Bureau, the logistics industry is the single biggest employer of working class white men in America. They get it. Of course, automation and globalisation have different impacts in different industries. Many traditional working class American voters who live in communities that are dramatically affected by the modern change, such as coal mining industry and manufacturing towns, they feel disenfranchised and left behind. And this is best illustrated by the emergence of a pretty amazing political divide based on education. This slide drills down on a specific and increasingly critical aspect of electoral support in the United States: educational attainment. While significant public commentary since the 2016 election has focused on the role of race, gender, and geography, this slide reveals that education is without doubt the most crucial factor when predicting electoral support. In fact, this data proves it to be the new electoral divide in the United States. rather than a Democrat blue wall or a Republican red wall, there actually exists a wall between voting preferences based on the different levels of educational attainment. The data is clear. States like Massachusetts, New York, California, or up the top, you've got Washington, D.C. They have the highest percentage of residents with professional degrees such as medicine, law, and engineering. And they're much more likely to vote for blue Democratic candidates. Remember, blue is the Democrats, red the Republicans. Conversely, states where there are fewer residents in possession of professional degrees, like Arkansas, Texas, and Iowa, well, they tend to vote Republican. I'm sure people can think of some parallels here in Australia, not mentioning Canberra. So with an increasing education and security divide in the community, Americans emphatically rejected the concept of maintaining the same policies Barack Obama had pursued over the last 8 years. Even though President Obama had good poll numbers for a retiring president, most Americans wanted change. They rejected another Bush and they rejected another Clinton. They didn't want Republicans or Democrats. This quest for change was the single biggest driver of a vote for a majority of American voters in 2016. And this slide reveals that their thirst for such change was even more evident in 2016 than in the historic election of Barack Obama in 2008, supposedly the high watermark of change politics. The early warning signs of the power of change were most evident in the Republic and Democrat primaries. Both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders drew huge crowds of new energetic supporters to their campaigns. In truth, those new supporters were not wedded to the old political parties. They were highly motivated advocates for disrupting the mainstream of politics. The desire to lash out at the establishment was there for all to see on both sides of politics, and it's been building for years. For anyone involved deeply in politics, this next graph is known as a killer graph. It's a government killer graph. This slide illustrates that the thirst for change is not a new phenomenon. The red line is the percentage of Americans that believe the country is heading in the wrong direction. They have felt that way for at least 12 years. They have been given messages of hope before, but in the minds of many voters, hope never became a reality. If 65% of people think the country is heading in the wrong direction and have done so for more than a decade, when a candidate asks for your vote and implores you to vote for him with a rhetorical question, "What do you got to lose?" it has incredibly powerful cut-through. And that's what candidate Trump did. Naturally, if people think the country is heading in the wrong direction and they have an opportunity to change that direction, they will take the risk. So it is very difficult for an incumbent political candidate to win based on their track record. And that's been one of the most significant changes in my 20 years involved in politics. As a result, the incumbent can only win if they destroy their opponent. They have to make the transaction cost of change so high that voters default to the devil they know, who is better than the devil they don't know. Regrettably, this is the most orthodox political play in 21st century politics. You know what? The Clinton campaign knew it to be true. That's why 100% of Hillary Clinton's advertising dollars featured Donald Trump. She set out to destroy him. Because Hillary Clinton was labelled an incumbent, only 10% of Donald Trump's advertising needed to feature Mrs. Clinton. As a result, 95% of all political advertising during the campaign featured Donald Trump, whether it was with him or against him. The more the media, past presidents, Hollywood celebrities, and the elites campaigned for Hillary Clinton, the more it reminded voters that she was the establishment candidate. And when establishment Republicans started campaigning for Hillary Clinton, the deal was done. Donald Trump truly became the outsider who would stand up against the establishment. Drain the swamp became a devastating cut-through political line. Of course, this was not enough on its own. Even though Donald Trump had assumed the Jacksonian mantle, it meant little if he failed to focus on the issues that mattered most to everyday Americans in particular, jobs and security. So ironically, the nominated candidate for America's grand old party of American politics had to deliver policy disruption that in places broke with Republican orthodoxy. He railed against established Republican policies on free trade, immigration, and religious tolerance. And with Teddy Roosevelt-like enthusiasm, he challenged big business and sidled up to a military that felt under-resourced and underexposed. This slide reveals part of the answer as to why the strongman changemaker Donald Trump was so attractive to many Americans. These figures need neither introduction nor context. They tell the tale of the hollowing out of middle America after the global financial crisis, and it is devastating. For an average American family, their assets nearly halved in value in the 7 years after the global financial crisis. The median net worth of many American families has effectively wound back 33 years to 1983. Add job insecurity and ageing population to the equation, and you have a pretty disgruntled constituency. For some people in the world, the global financial crisis has now been reduced to a bad memory, or perhaps a catchy acronym, GFC. But for many Americans, it remains an economic cataclysm, for which they and their families and communities have still not recovered almost a decade later. So surely you can see and understand the narrative going through the minds of these voters. You know, if someone from Des Moines, Iowa, saying, you know what, my family and my community are going backwards, yet the elites are okay, they're okay. They lecture us on technology, climate change, who we can marry and whether we can carry a gun. They make billions on Wall Street and Silicon Valley, doing things that only the smart ones can do, and I end up paying. Meanwhile, they call us all deplorable. They seem to think it's a good thing that our factories are closing and our coal mines are closing. When we are threatened with violence in our community or against our community, we don't see them going out and fighting for us. When did you last see someone from Wall Street or Silicon Valley join the Marines or join the police force? We have to fight for ourselves. We need someone, anyone, to stand up for our interests. It's what they're thinking. I get it. I'm sure you do as well. The American people no longer have confidence that their traditional institutions are protecting their interests. For a nation that has a reputation for always respecting and admiring their institutions, this graft is the most telling. As you can see, there has been a dramatic loss of confidence over the last 30 years in many of America's most revered institutions. Institutions that are local to a community or involve protecting a community are most revered. So small business, local doctors and local police are respected. The military is revered because not only is it keeping Americans safe, but there are military bases in virtually every US state. To give you context, for example, Australia has military personnel based in 31 US states. Most Australians wouldn't know that. The institutions that have clearly lost the support of the American people are more removed from their everyday life. Big business, big banks, big government, and big Washington, in the form of the presidency and the Congress, have lost the confidence of a vast number of Americans. And the Trump campaign didn't miss this opportunity. The candidate railed against the things everyday Americans felt they've lost control of, such as trade deals, immigration policy, big media, and of course Washington DC. He lauded the military and the police and offered huge tax cuts to small business. Since coming to office, the president has not let up on his attacks, and this has helped to inoculate his support base with the lines that his supporters can use against his never-waning critics. For example, any claims he does not like that are made by some media organisations are fake news. His war against the media does have popular support. In his battle with Congress, he has popular support. Channeling this anger at Washington proves highly effective for Donald Trump, as he was seen as the only candidate that was willing to say what many Americans have been thinking for generations. That is, that the establishment, personified by the federal government in Washington, no longer worked in the best interests of the American people. As this research reveals, in 1958, 73% of Americans surveyed agreed that they trusted the US federal government always or most of the time. As of today, 19%. Complete collapse. The overwhelming majority of Americans have lost faith in their government, no matter which party is in power. As a result, the presidential election held on November 8, 2016, heralded the arrival of disruption into the mainstream of American politics. This is one that'll please Jared. When Donald Trump labelled newspapers such as the New York Times and Washington Post as failing enterprises staffed by fools promulgating fake news, he was motivated by some pretty strong anti-Trump opinions. This slide clearly highlights that less than 5% of newspapers in the United States that made an endorsement chose to endorse the red Republican candidate in the presidential election in 2016. It's further evidence of the disconnect that exists between the establishment in America, including many sections of the mass media, and tens of millions of Americans that chose to vote for Donald Trump. So as you can see, in 1972, more than 90% of editorials were in favour of the Republicans, and there's been a pretty consistent trend there, to the point where more than 90% of the editorials favour the Democrats. Beyond the United States, many people throughout the world are united by their disappointment and anger at institutions and political leaders, the establishment. They feel they've been betrayed and abandoned. A closer look at the state of the world reveals that anti-establishment sentiment and populist sentiment is widespread in many regions, although it certainly takes different forms depending on local conditions. This graph illustrates the elusiveness of political stability and certainty right around the world. All the areas coloured in have experienced some form of political disruption over the last 5 years. Where there is democracy, then there's tended to be changes in leadership or government. Where democracy is weak, there may be a form of authoritarian leadership that absolutely smothers dissent. Alternately, armed insurrection emerges that challenges the existing governance structures. Over recent decades, the United States and the world beyond its borders has witnessed an incredible centralisation of power, especially in the realm of business and political governance. The creation and expansion of multilateral institutions, including the United Nations, the European Union, and the World Trade Organization, have been seen by many as undermining the once sacrosanct doctrine of Westphalian sovereignty, and in turn the belief of regular citizens that they have the power to speak their mind and influence the direction of their own communities. Unlike Australians, who tend to focus on the services provided by government rather than political philosophy underpinning government itself, generally, Americans are opposed to the concept of big government. Instead, they prefer to focus on the government's role in protecting and facilitating the rights and responsibilities of the individual. While this can be clearly divined from even a casual review of American history, continues to be a strong and consistent theme running through modern American society and culture. One of my favourite examples being the official slogan of the great state of New Hampshire, which is, live free or die. Not even the West Australians would embrace that. So while Australians generally seek to defend their rights, I can't see any Australian states rushing to embrace that as an official slogan. If we are to truly understand the real mainstream of the United States and the deep disruption it currently experiences, it's critical to remember that Americans have a very different outlook on politics and government based on the unique history and culture. And this is such a telling statistic. America suffered more casualties in the US Civil War than it suffered in every other war combined. So a nation that has the capacity to turn on itself should celebrate, and we should celebrate with them, the safety valve of democracy that allows everyone to have a voice. Whether it be the United States of America or other parts of the world, it is clear that there is a connection between the centralisation of political power and the disaffection and impotence felt by many citizens where this is occurring. As political and economic power has been increasingly consolidated in faraway cities, whether it be capital city like Washington or a super city such as Brussels, regular citizens have become increasingly distant from their own governments, both geographically and often ideologically. They don't trust institutions that they can't directly influence. And in an age where power has rapidly been devolved to individuals in their capacities as consumers, either through the mobility of capital, through global commerce, or through social media, it's time for governments to catch up with their citizens. Without more control over the direction of their countries, and therefore their own future, many citizens in the mainstream of the United States or beyond will continue to use the ballot box or, God forbid, other means to achieve the disruption they feel is necessary for their voices to be heard. So what does the mainstreaming of disruption mean for Australia's relationship with the United States? In my view, we must avoid the temptation to become constant critics of the new US administration, because it's not a carbon copy of previous administrations. The new Trump administration is very focused on practical policy outcomes. It's not beholden to ideology or tradition. It's not in the DNA of the administration to procrastinate or give undue deference to process. Whilst the necessary skill sets vary from policy area to policy area, I believe President Trump has chosen a very credible cabinet. In keeping with the quest for a break with the past sought by many Trump voters, this slide perfectly captures how the mood has affected the composition of the President's cabinet. Specifically, as you can see, there's a reduced number of cabinet appointees with prior government experience, a dramatic increase from the administrations of both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, which rings true with the stated intention of draining the swamp. Further, one in four cabinet appointees have served as a CEO, chief executive, in their prior career, which is again in keeping with an administration which is focused on deal-making. And lastly, there's not a single cabinet member that currently holds a PhD. A different kind of education wall, to be sure, but as the slide reveals, an obvious break from past practice, and in part a reflection of that slide before about the education divide. The new administration has very little experience in government. It's also going to be challenged by a strident Congress, where 72% of Republicans have never worked with a Republican president. For years, many of them have campaigned against the White House. Now they have to work out how to work with the White House. We are seeing the complex repercussions of this on a daily basis in Washington, from engagement between the White House and the Congress in areas such as intelligence matters to the rollout of an ambitious legislative agenda. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are at the beginning. At this stage, it's crucial for us to remember that it's only the beginning of the Trump administration. While pundits will seek to endlessly speculate and make definitive statements each and every day about a range of issues concerning the Trump administration, it's wise to avoid such speculation and instead rely on the facts. You know, they've cut out of my speech my line here. I said if this was the first day of a 5-day international test cricket match, we'd still be in the first session on the first day. But it certainly doesn't feel like that for many people. As I said, we're 69 days into the 4-year tenure of the Trump administration. It means there's 1,392 days to go, 95% of the set term. Even more pertinent, as of the 22nd of March, 553 key Trump administration positions requiring confirmation by the Senate, 495 haven't even been nominated, 38 are waiting actual confirmation by the Senate, and only 20 have been confirmed. So they arguably haven't even formed an administration. This means that less than 3% of nominees are actually in position. And by the way, I think the President has well over 2,000 appointments. So they're the significant appointments. And then spends the rest of the day doing his other job. In my view, the election of Donald Trump has given keen observers around the world a unique opportunity to appreciate what the United States actually is. It's an immensely complex and diverse nation. And it is a great nation. It is a great nation. Like many people and their governments, Australians have a tendency to view our interactions with the United States through a narrow prism of our own interests, and that's pretty understandable. If November the 8th reminded us of anything, it's that all politics is local. And ultimately, it's domestic politics that drives foreign policy, not the other way around, as some may wish it be. And this formula works for Donald Trump. This slide reveals that Republican voters rated Donald Trump's performance at the conclusion of his first 2 months in office more highly than the performance of President George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and amazingly Ronald Reagan at the same point in their first year in office. This is contrary to all the media reports. The end of February, 76% of Republicans approved of Donald Trump's performance as president, according to the non-partisan and well-regarded Pew Research Center. Those people that voted for change are pretty happy with his performance. So far, they accept he's delivering on his promises. He is their president, and they are forgiving of his sins. They will continue to cut him more slack as he tries to shake up the system of government that they want to disrupt. I suspect the failure to repeal the US Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's known, will have little negative impact on Donald Trump's standing with his own voters. It will be seen as a failure of the system and will reflect poorly on the already poorly regarded Congress. But repeated failure does have a cost. The goodwill and tolerance of your voter base can be patient for only so long. And even though Donald Trump won over Abraham Lincoln's log cabin voter, he's clearly not a log cabin kind of guy. Andrew Jackson had humble beginnings, as many very successful political disruptors have over time. The log cabin. So whilst Joe the plumber voted for Donald Trump, if things go really bad for the president, then he'll have to work much harder than ever to convince his heartland voters that he is one of them. So, ladies and gentlemen, only 2 months in, President Trump already has a fair claim to being a 21st century Andrew Jackson. But it's early days. Donald Trump's election reflected all the frustrations of a huge number of Americans that have lived and breathed and experienced change that they didn't want. The question for the international community is, will the frustrations felt by the American people be exported to the rest of the world during President Trump's term in office? Whatever the answer, rest assured that the days of business as usual have come to an end. Thank you very much.
Well, many thanks to the Ambassador for a terrific speech with lots of information. So we'll come to questions and discussion in 1 minute. Before we do, I should say thanks to Cause Chambers Westcar for the use of this fine facility this evening and the great visual system which made it easy to follow your various and many graphs. So we come to question and discussion. We finish at the top of the hour. As you know, if you... Tucker Carlson on Fox News has an emblem of a shot of the United States, which is essentially how the counties voted. So it's overwhelmingly red, apart from the coast, the northeast and the west coast, but apart from that it's overwhelmingly red, indicating along the lines of what you're talking about, how if you go outside of the big cities and the educated areas, you find a different kind of America. Now, I agree with you, it's far, far, far too early to make any predictions, but would you see the next election being fought where the last election was fought, that is in places like Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin? Does President Trump need to go beyond that, or can he get by doing essentially what he did last time?
So, Jared, you're asking me to predict the next election. I'm pretty proud of myself for predicting the last one. I think you did quite well, too. It's a lonely club. It was a lonely club. I've got to remind myself I'm a diplomat here. The thing is, Donald Trump is appealing to his heartland. You actually don't really need to have a majority in this world anymore. You've just got to have a huge minority. And I tend to believe that we've seen, maybe for a short period of time, I don't know, the end of consensus politics around the world. It's a big issue. And therefore, he is appealing directly to his target audience. He's appealing directly to his people. He's keeping faith with those people. He's rolling out his agenda. And they're likely to stick with him. And they're hardline Republicans. And by the way, the first electoral test is the midterms. And by the way, those Republicans need to get the endorsement of their own conferences. So there's only so many times, if Donald Trump is hugely popular with the Republican base, and there's a congressman in the way of his agenda, sooner or later, that congressman's going to find a few, in an Australian equivalent, pre-selection problems, right? And Donald Trump, you know, the moment he starts going out to some of those districts where there have been identified Republicans that voted against the agenda that Republicans found to be very attractive, like the end of trade deals or building a wall or the repeal of Obamacare or tax cuts or infrastructure or closing down climate change initiatives, sooner or later, they're going to find it to be a pretty difficult process. Now, there's no way I'm predicting the next election. Anywhere.
George here, there's a question. Just start, George. We'll get a microphone to you. Yep.
Well, it was a very clear and insightful picture about how we got here and how things stand. And I appreciate your caveats about crystal balls and looking forward, but I'm going to be a bit like Jared here and ask you to do that. Trump, like all populists, eventually will disappoint his followers. So when that happens, how do you think events will play out?
If Donald Trump were not to be the President of the United States in 6 months, a year, 2 years, or 4 years, the same issues are there. and there'll be someone else along. And people will become increasingly frustrated. And this is not, I don't believe, you know, we just had a fantastic meeting of all the Australian ambassadors in Canberra for 2 days. And there was a lot of discussion about what's happening in different countries around the world. I mean, they've got anti-immigration rights in South Africa. You've got an incredibly tight election coming up in France. And if Marine Le Pen wins in France, it has massive implications for the EU. Massive. Massive for the world, right? I'm not forming a judgment on it, but it's just got massive implications. You've got a whole lot of disruptions going on right around the world. And this is motivated, in my view, by the fact that, you know, we've got rapid change. I think the total sum of human knowledge at the moment is doubling every 12 months. It's a startling statistic because of the computer age, because of innovation. And change, if you have change, uninvited change in your life, you go through all those emotions that many people have sort of speculated. You go through grief and anger and frustration. Well, the world is going through change on a scale never seen before in history. If you're a taxi driver, you've got Uber. I mean, if you're a printer, you've got email now. You know, every single aspect of our lives is in a bit of a flummox, so much so that, you know, within of all the jobs that exist today, 70% won't be around in 30 years. So how do you train for a career? How do you study? It's really challenging, right? I tend to see things as opportunities. But for those people who, you know, are trying to plan out their lives, it's pretty challenging. And what they want is the government, any government, to provide stability and certainty and predictability, and to deliver what they need in their lives that they can't get from the latest technology or can't get from other parts of the community. So, you know, Donald Trump was elected on the basis that he saw that. He said, right, I'm speaking for you, and I'm going to deliver what you want. And they said, yes, we like that. Rather than delivering what the candidate wants, we want someone to speak for us. And if it's not Donald Trump, it will be someone else. It will be someone else. So that's why I've been saying we should put aside our emotions, whatever they might be, optimism, pessimism about what's happened in the United States, and just deal with the reality that the world is changing. You know, the United States is by and away, far and away, our most crucial ally and most reliable business partner.
Question,
over the first 90 days, I've seen President, sorry to use the word, but piss off many of its traditional allies, us included, for a short period of time. How has your job changed in the last 90 days as a result of that change in attitude by the President?
Well, you know, I mean, the President and our Prime Minister have the sort of honest relationship based on mutual respect that every Prime Minister and President have had. I mean, the relationship between Australia and the United States, and I confess, even I didn't know how deep it was in certain areas, like in intelligence activity, in the military, we've got military personnel in 31 US states. We are buying, we're spending $15 million a day purchasing military equipment from the United States that is giving us a huge and hugely important military for the 21st century. I mean, they are just so crucial to us in so many areas for the protection of our citizens. They are by far and away the biggest investor in Australia of any foreign country. And we have shared values. And there'll be prime ministers, there'll be presidents, you know, there'll be differences. But the depth of the relationship between Americans and Australians is phenomenal. And I just make the final observation, I think all Australians know. There are about 150,000 dead American boys buried in the sand between Australia and Japan. I've always seen that as an intergenerational debt. You know, and it's one of the reasons why we'll overcome any changes or any differences on both sides.
Question here.
Thank you very much. You describe in detail some of the economic institutional reasons for the election of Donald Trump, but beyond those, sometimes there are psychological and mental processes that cause people to make such a revolutionary change. And I'm particularly thinking here about the last 30 or 40 years in which such movements as political correctness, identity politics, in the United States universities, for example, in many social science faculties, 99% of faculty are Democrats and don't know a single Republican. So there is a kind of a mental landscape there where the educated people, particularly those who have PhDs, think in one particular way, which is totally detached
okay,
from the way
be brief.
The other thing. So really my question is, how significant do you think is political correctness and identity politics in alienating a large mass of American voters?
Well, I don't think it's only American voters. I think people just don't like political leaders telling them what to say and how to think. I think, that's not unique to the United States. I think it's real. And you know, with the advent of the internet, people have become individually massively empowered. I mean, I remember when, you had to write a letter to the editor to express your view or really queue up for talkback radio to get, maybe you'd get on and maybe someone would be listening. I even remember Gary O'Callaghan, all these things. And now, through Twitter, through Facebook, you can broadcast to the whole world, right? So you're empowered. And your bank, you remember when you had to go to the bank manager and the bank had to be open in order to get money out. Remember that, right? Now, anywhere in the world, you can get money out from a machine in a wall, or actually you don't even have to do that. You can do it over the internet and move money anywhere in the world. And media, you can see any newspaper, any content, anywhere in the world now, right here on your phone. But politically and from a business perspective, you remember when your local bank manager used to be in the community? All gone. Now the bank manager is basically, in and out over months, no community engagement. That's why they hate big banks. And you remember when the factory manager used to be the guy that decides whether we produce this many cars over these weeks and used to be able to go to them and say, look, I want to do an extra shift. Well, somehow Detroit or Tokyo took that all away from us. And of course, the decisions aren't made in my local community. They're now made, actually, in Brussels or in the UN. And people say, hang on, I've had enough. If I'm empowered in my everyday life with information, with money, with choice, then why is it that in these other places they're making the decisions about my destiny and I have no say? So I think people are saying we want the same empowerment when it comes to the destiny of our nations as we have in our everyday lives. And over 30 years, the most effective policy initiative I've seen in operation at a community level is Neighbourhood Watch. Still going quite strong because people feel that they've got some control over their local community, right down to their local house, their local street. So I think we've all got an obligation to think about how to make that work at a more international level.
Christian, don't stand up. Christian here.
Yes. Thank you for your presentation, Joe. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, because there is another country in our region that's very large, has the largest or second largest economy, depending on which measure you use, China, who's watching what's going on in America, all this disruption, and in comparison, it's a communist stable regime, relatively stable regime. And then we have countries which are bordering between, choosing between China and the US. How do you think the Trump administration will affect these relationships?
Well, I think a lot of countries in the Asian region are looking a little cautious, but just holding back, but looking carefully. As are countries that have seen, look, when there's change, you don't immediately rush in. You've got to think about it, what it means. And as I said, they've only got, 3% of their significant appointments made in the new administration. So it's very early days, even though there's been a lot of, extraordinary activity. Look, the relationship, I've had quite a bit to do with China over the years. In fact, I was very blessed. My parents took me to China for the first time in 1977. Second ever tour group to China. And I remember, Beijing, when no building was more than four stories high, everyone was wearing green suits or blue suits. Everyone was on push bikes. And people came up to me, and I was still pretty young, and they squeezed my cheek because they'd never seen a white guy before. You believe that? Compare it to China now, which is, incredibly dynamic country and second biggest, even arguably the biggest economy in the world. And we are in an unbelievably unique and privileged position in Australia. Our business partner, if we were a small business, our business partner is the biggest business on earth. And our biggest customer is the second biggest business on earth. And, we're sticking with our partner. And they might have a disagreement. My other partner might have a disagreement with my big customer. But actually, we've got the opportunity to help to bring them together. A leadership opportunity. And it's, we've got two friends and one ally.
Final question off the bat.
Joe, thank you for the interesting presentation. There are a lot of disruptors in the world, but very few people that manage change well.
Yeah.
And business has been through huge disruption, as you mentioned. Politics has yet to go through it, although, as you quite rightly said, it's beginning to do so. Do you think Donald Trump might be one of those people that's capable of leading significant change and remoulding the American political system to sort of adapt it in a way that business has had to adapt to change?
Well, the American the people that designed the US Constitution were clearly geniuses. Because there's a power sharing. It's similar to our system in one sense. You've got the three arms of government, of institutions. You've got the judiciary, the empowered and independent judiciary. You've got the parliament and you've got the administration. And the President of the United States has significant power in international affairs, but relies very heavily on Congress for domestic activity. So that's why, presidents that tend to start their terms on domestic issues and finish their terms on international issues, because that's pretty akin to how the power struggle works. I'm not going to break my own rule and start to opine on what the Trump administration is going to look like in a year or two. I'm just going to be realistic about it and say, right, on behalf of Australia, which is my job, on behalf of all of you, on the whole country, how do I help us to be a good friend and partner of the United States? And so I'm working with the entire diplomatic mission, with the foreign minister, with the prime minister. We're offering suggestions to the new administration on how to, in one area that I'm familiar with, infrastructure, how to roll out infrastructure and the asset recycling scheme I introduced in Australia in my 2014 budget. It's been, you look around Sydney and there are cranes everywhere, and in many ways that's a result of the asset recycling. Painful as it was to sell electricity, getting rid of the electricity and redeploying the net proceeds into new infrastructure has been a winner for Sydney. Second highest number of cranes in the world in Sydney. And the good news is I'm not here to experience the delays on the roads, right? So don't blame me for that. Don't blame Gladys. But you know, what a great story for Sydney, right? Well, in the US, they haven't got a lazy $1 trillion around to roll out infrastructure. But you know what? They've got governments that owned airports and ports. Massive, you know, LAX, John F. Kennedy Airport. They're owned by governments that pay no tax. State governments that pay no tax. So if they actually privatise them or lease them, they'll start to pay revenue and they can redeploy it into new infrastructure. Sounds pretty good to me. Worked in Australia. So we're actively offering that advice for free. Now they can take it, leave it, but we're actually offering something. And of course in areas that are strategically important, we're also offering advice. Now, we're offering it as good faith allies that have fought with them for 100 years, side by side. We are the only country on earth that has been side by side with the United States in every single major conflict for 100 years. So, you know, when events occur in the US, sometimes that might be critical of Australia, we get overwhelmed and flooded by the leaders in America saying, we're with you. And so that gives us a certain amount of money in the bank that allows us to offer advice. And they love our honesty. They love the fact that we're not always asking them for things, as many other countries do. They love the fact that we're thoughtful, we've got shared values, and they appreciate that, you know, we'll fight together, we'll die together, but most importantly, we have the same destiny if we continue to share those values.
Many thanks, Ambassador.
Thanks very much.
So it's, I know there were more questions, but we always have a rule of finishing on time. It's great to have Joe Hockey back at the Sydney Institute. Thanks, Ambassador, for a terrific speech. At the Institute, we love facts, and we had your assessment, but we also had a lot of facts and a lot of very interesting opinion polling, which I think a lot of us will take away and look at further. But just to conclude very briefly, I think Ambassador Hockey is just what Australia needs in Washington representing us. He's an ex-politician, now a diplomat, who respects the view of the electors of the United States and who has a realistic attitude to government, understands that Australia has to cooperate with our great ally, who currently has one president, who may one day have another president, and has just got a realistic attitude, which is exactly what we want. And what we have here tonight is a realistic assessment of the contemporary United States with a focus on disruption. So congratulations, well done, and we'll love to have you back sometime in the future. But for today, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.